back to Bluegrass Bios on Lexington Community Radio. Kyle, Ben, and Lex with you live from STEAM Academy. With us in studio is Lexington consultant, columnist, podcaster, publisher, student, advisor, and longtime news anchor. And by the way, the keyboardist for our theme song. He's an institution of Kentucky media. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tom Martin.
What do I do?
Yeah, I felt like we needed to clap there.
Thank you for coming in, Tom.
Oh, I appreciate the invitation.
So I've listened to a few of your interviews now, and I have to start in a logical place. Were you born with that voice, or did you make a deal with the devil?
I was born. My father had a terrific voice, and so I grew up around him. And I grew up in Eastern Kentucky. And when I decided I wanted to try radio, somebody said, "You know, you need to try to do something about your accent." And at the time, I was really offended. And most of us still are offended from Eastern Kentucky when we're told that we need to, quote-unquote, do something about our accent. But this was the late 60s, and back then, you know, the typical network voice was you couldn't tell what part of the country they were from. Usually it had a Midwestern aspect to it, but otherwise it was pretty much accent-free. So I took voice and articulation at Morehead State University and learned how to speak that way. And now, frankly, when I hear a more natural voice and a more natural accent on the radio, I much prefer it.
Okay. So that was just, I mean, that's coming off of Walter Cronkite, right? You've got kind of a Cronkite quality to your cadence. But are you noticing that now in broadcast there's not such a demand for that sort of non-regional dialect?
Definitely. I think one of the turning points was probably for Morning Edition on NPR when Steve Inskeep became the Morning Edition host. His predecessor, of course, had had a mellifluous, beautiful voice. And Steve also has a great voice, but he's not all about that. It's more relaxed. He talks like Steve talks. If you were to talk to Steve in person, he would sound exactly the same.
How does that preference of a more natural voice show a change in how journalism and how media has adapted over the years or become more natural, more human?
I think more natural and more genuine. And I think, to me, it also enhances credibility. I guess it could be also abused in that way and is abused in that way. But when I hear somebody speaking as they speak, as opposed to forcing themselves into an artificial accent or delivery, I'm probably going to listen to them and believe them more readily than the other.
Media professional Tom Martin in studio with us. You said that you left Morehead State as a student when your advisors basically told you, Tom, you've learned everything we can teach you. It's time to go out and get a job. What was broadcast journalism training like in the late 60s?
It was, at Morehead at least, in its infancy, and that's why that happened, because it really had not matured to a level that I would have liked to have pursued. And I had great advisors, and they understood that, and they understood that I had taken a real shine to broadcasting and really enjoyed it, because I was also working at the local commercial radio station at the same time. And so they said, you know, if an opportunity comes your way out there, the only real way to learn this is to get out there and get yourself before a microphone, and also away from that microphone and everything else that goes on inside a real radio station, and learn it. And that's what I did.
Your first couple of years in news broadcast, you learned the ropes in smaller markets. Mm-hmm. You were a PA in Asheville, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Then you went to Roanoke, Virginia, and then Spartanburg, South Carolina. How did that on-the-job training, on and off the mic, as you say, prepare you for the larger opportunities that you would get soon after?
Well, it was gradual and incremental, and I'd say the most instructive experiences had to be the actual getting out of the station and covering local news and going to city council, covering fires, you name it. And then the coming back and processing what I had seen and witnessed and reported through an editorial process, ensuring that I was not being unfair to anybody, being accurate. There were occasions when you're not, and you're called on it, and well, you should be. And those are learning experiences as well. So there's a bit of trial and error at that level. Unfortunately, today, we don't have the newsrooms that in radio that we had in those days. They were, at KQV in Pittsburgh in particular, it was a big city newsroom with mobile units and reporters and editors, and this was strictly radio. Today, with the advent of the Telecommunications Act, which, broke up Ma and Pa radio, we don't have that anymore. It's centralized.
Could you tell us about how you mentioned that you were at an ABC affiliate in Pittsburgh? Mm-hmm. Could you tell us how you got handpicked by another news director and how you ended up at the AP radio network in Washington?
Yeah, that was really fun. We were as an ABC owned radio station. We were part of that ABC owned radio station constellation out there. And so we traded reports that if somebody in San Francisco at KGO, for example, had an interview or a story that was somehow relevant in Pittsburgh, they'd let us know and feed it to us, and we'd do the same thing. So I got to know the news director at KGO, a guy named Bob Benson, who went on to be hired by the Associated Press to create AP Radio in Washington, D.C. So he started looking around the ABC radio stations, not the network, for likely candidates to come help him do that. As it happened, KQV, right about then, was put on the block and was being sold, so I was extra motivated to take Bob up on his offer and did that.
Do you remember the date that you got to Washington?
I do. It was the night that Richard Nixon resigned. And we were being put up in a place called the Guest Quarters, straight across the street from the Watergate. And I get chills still thinking about that night because it was, you could have cut the atmosphere with a knife.
Now, weren't the lookouts in that hotel? Because they were across the street, weren't they?
Yeah, they could have been.
Yeah.
They could have been. But we walked down to the White House, and it was a circus atmosphere. It was just incredible. The White House was besieged. It was surrounded. And, of course, at that age, all of us were in our mid-20s. We'd seen all the president's men, and we all wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein.
Right?
So the first thing the Associated Press did was to march all of us into a conference room and say, that's not what's going to happen here. And just, you can put away your three-piece suits. You're not going to be doing that. And in fact, because of Watergate, we had imposed on us some very stringent editorial rules that we had to follow, especially where quoting anonymous sources was concerned, because that was a big thing during Watergate. And we were told that we will not entertain an anonymous source unless you can independently corroborate that information and we can confirm it, which was next to impossible. So we didn't do those stories.
And at the time, the studios weren't even completed yet, right?
Right.
So you guys must have been chomping at the bit for a couple of months.
We were going crazy. It took about a month for them to complete them. So they had all of us meeting every day. We were all trying to find a place to live and all that. But every day we came into the city, and they had basically commandeered the Sidewalk Cafe near 1825 K Street. And that's where we met every day. And we watched the passing show and talked about what we were going to do and planned and plotted. And that was great fun, great time.
How did those meetings help to build a newsroom that worked together well and efficiently?
Well, it was fascinating because we had all these people that were coming in from all over the country to staff AP Radio all at once, and all of them coming from from working newsrooms in cities as disparate as San Francisco, as Houston, Miami, wherever. And everybody brought something to the table that was a little bit different that would contribute to how the newsroom took shape. One of them was the experience of being on the other end of networks, because that's what we were about to become. So we brought a consumer's perspective to the network table and said, when we were out there taking feeds from, let's say, ABC News, downloading actuality, we call it, which is sound bites, mm-hmm. It was difficult because of this, or it was easy because of this. So let's incorporate those things in what we're doing. And in those days, one of the things we devised, our engineers devised, was a thing called the pinball machine. It was this huge, tall set of racks of cart machines. Do you still have a cart machine? I guess we don't use those anymore, mm-hmm. do we?
It's not literal anymore. Yeah, it's all on virtual. The screen. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, these were actually almost like 8-track tapes that you shove in a slot, and there was a whole rack of them there. And every hour, we fed out our sound bites, rack by rack, to the affiliates, and the person operating that pinball machine by day was Candy Crowley. CNN
yeah.
fame, who went on to become, you know, a very well-known CNN correspondent. Mm-hmm. And in fact, many AP radio staffers went on to become the launch staffers for CNN.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You brought up the sound bites a couple of times. I have to bring up your Peabody Award. If you could explain to the audience, it was you won for Best Radio News Documentary. Can you tell us what your team there created and why it was such an innovation?
It was based on a study that the Associated Press had done to find ways to become more competitive against UPI Audio, which was already up and running and had been for quite some time. They were the Associated Press's direct competitor. And we always used to joke in our newsroom that you can't spell stupid without UPI, but you can't spell cheap without AP. So. But of course, that was our perspective. The guys at UPI had a completely different point of view.
Right.
But you know, we were all friends off air too. There were great people over there. But we wanted to know if their approach to radio was turning people off, or if it was because it was different from the commercial networks. Their reports were much longer, and often they didn't have any sound other than the reporter talking for a minute and a half. So the Associated Press commissioned a pretty extensive survey and study to find out what people's listening tolerances really were. And actually, they came down to, at that time, a huge 25 seconds.
Right.
So we were commissioned by my partner in this was John Holloman, who you might remember from the first Gulf War. He and Bernie Shaw and Peter Arnett were the three guys in the hotel room in Baghdad calling it as cruise missiles were coming through the city or being fired through the city. Bernie Shaw was under the bed. Peter Arnett, the former Vietnam correspondent, was fearless, so he was walking around writing down everything. And John, who was a country boy from Georgia, was leaning out the window as though it was 4th of July. But John was a great guy, and he went on to become a well-known correspondent at CNN. In fact, and I'm getting off track here, but I got to tell this story.
Sure.
John was determined to become the first journalist in space and to co-anchor something with Walter Cronkite before he retired. So Ted Turner, who really liked John, took him up on it, and he had arranged for John to go up on a Soyuz, a Russian space capsule, and to co-anchor John Glenn's return to space with Walter Cronkite. Unfortunately, John, on a Saturday prior to this, went out to the grocery store and was killed in an accident and didn't realize his dream. But John and I were assigned to do this documentary in a way that would respond to that study. So we were to find sound bites that responded to that. So what we did was go out. Our theme was the use of U.S. food aid and assistance as leverage in American diplomacy around the world, to go to a country that was maybe teetering toward a communist or totalitarian regime. The United States often would step in with food assistance to persuade the country in a different direction. So we went out to various embassies all over Washington and recorded the interviews and brought them back and had a edit booth similar to this room that we're in now. At that time, we were using tape. So we would download our interviews onto tape, find a section we wanted to use, clip it out, and with masking tape, put a number on the end of it, put a corresponding number and the information about that interviewee on a legal pad, and then tape the tape to the wall. By the time we were through, this booth was completely full of tape hanging from the walls.
25 seconds each or so.
Approximately. And so our task, and this took a year and a half or so to do, was to put together a narrative using those sound bites. And there was very little of us. It was mostly sound bites. And it was an extremely challenging and an intricate process to do that. But from that was born the concept of the soundbite. And now we're down to an average listener capacity of about 8 seconds.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
What was
that? Yeah. we're on with Tom Martin, a former ABC News and AP Radio news anchor. So, Tom, you eventually go from D.C. And correct me if I've got any of this wrong, but you start working for ABC News again, but this time in New York.
RKO before that.
Okay. What was that like, getting to the epicenter, really, of media in the world?
I loved Washington, D.C. I really did. And I couldn't imagine leaving it for New York. But when the opportunity knocked, when RKO created a second radio network and did basically the same thing that AP Radio did, they recruited from around the country, I decided to explore it and went up to New York and instantly just was blown away by the street, frankly, and not to mention the people that I would be working with and the experience. And so I was at RKO for 10 years, and it went through several ownerships while I was there, sat at the same exact desk, pounding away on a Selectric typewriter. Does anybody know what one of those is?
Yes.
Our copy was in duplicate, and we had fantastic copy editors. And the thing that I first, when you're asked what you think of a place, the first thing your mind goes to is usually the right thing. It's the thing that you enjoyed most. I was the morning drive anchor, so my day was over by about 11 a.m. At the first month I was there, they were putting us up in a hotel up on Central Park South. So I would walk back from the network on 41st and Broadway. And in New York City, you can just find a bench and sit down and watch the passing show and be incredibly entertained for nothing. It's just an unbelievable place.
It's where you ended up spending the bulk of your news anchoring career, right? Mm-hmm. In New York?
Yeah. I was at AP Radio from 74 to 81, and then RKO from 81 to 90. And then when the Gulf War broke out, interesting story, I guess, that happened with that is that RKO had been sold again. Dick Clark bought it and moved it to suburban D.C. so that he would, in Virginia, which was a right-to-work state, no union. So we were given the option of either moving with them or taking a buyout and remaining in New York. So I thought, well, I had young kids at the time. I thought this is a great opportunity to be a Mr. Mom for a while. And I did that for a summer. And I was underneath my deck one day. It was in August, doing some work under my deck. And had my mobile phone. We didn't have cell phones then. Like the shape of a brick. And it rings, and I sat straight up and banged my head on the bottom of the deck, and I'm seeing stars, and I said, hello, and this is his voice. Hello, this is Dick Rosenbaum, ABC News. Is this Tom Martin? I'm like, yeah. Why? And I know this sounds incredible, but I've just injured myself answering the phone. Can I call you right back? So I called him back, and it turned out that, and they had, this was brilliant stroke on their part. They, back in those days, the networks had their own intelligence units, and they had determined that the incursion into Iraq was about to occur. So they wanted to get the jump on the other networks, NBC and CBS. And so they discovered that this network of people, RKO, largely was still in New York. We were all there. We were doing this, that, and the other. Why not just bring them all in here and create a fifth ABC News network to do nothing but cover the Gulf War? And we can do it overnight because they're here. And so I answered the call, and when the next day went in to meet. And everybody else that I'd worked with at RKO was sitting there at the table. And so we did that and covered it.
Were there other, I mean, that sounds like it was kind of innovative for the time, right? A news outlet that only covered basically one subject?
Because it was war, I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure that both NBC and CBS had dedicated staffs to do nothing but that, because it was really a 24/7 enterprise. We actually had speakers in our newsroom that were live at all times from our bureaus in Baghdad and Tel Aviv, and so that we could hear what was going on. So I think it was innovative of ABC to bring an entire network that was just sitting there dormant in and started overnight. They beat everybody else to the punch with that, but the others eventually caught up.
Because you had to cover it 24/7, how did that set almost a precedent for how news is covered now, now that we are 24/7 in all entities? Did that help pave a way for that?
It did. The ABC networks at that time, when I was there, there were four operating. And they were all 24-hour networks. One, the information network, its newscast at the top of the hour. The next one would be at quarter after, 30 and 45. And they served different demographics. Mm-hmm. Some were, one newscast was designed to fit into a rock format. The information I worked for, the network I worked for, the ABC Information Network, was more a standard traditional network. And so we were. I actually worked the overnight shifts a few times and fell asleep at my desk. And 24/7 had been going on for quite a while then, but it did set the stage for where we are now, which is nonstop, absolutely nonstop. I'm not sure whether that's good or bad. I'm really not, but that's where we are.
Peabody awarded news anchor Tom Martin in studio with us. Tom, before we get to the present, because I want to be able to talk about some of the things you're doing right now in Lexington, I have to ask you to tell the story of how you how do I put this, your last major job at for ABC before you returned home. You got an opportunity to sub for somebody.
Oh, sure.
Could you tell us about that?
Paul Harvey. and again, it was his friend Bob Benson from KGO, who I mentioned much earlier, who started AP Radio. He had since become the vice president for news at ABC, so he had come back to ABC. And I had been on the morning shift at the Information Network one morning, and I was walking down the hall after I got off the air, and Bob came up, and he was frantic, and he said, are you going home now? I was like, yeah. And he said, well, can you stick around for a while? I said, sure. He said, I need you to sit in for Paul. And it didn't register at first who he meant. And when he finally says, I'm talking about Paul Harvey. Are you up for that? Because the whole network rides on this. And I said, thanks for telling me that. If you hadn't told me that, I might be real. But I of course, you know, I'd love to try this. and so I did.
Actually, briefly, could you tell our listeners who Paul Harvey was? I've been sitting here trying to put it into words myself, and I can't quite do it.
Paul Harvey was a radio commentator. He was he rose to prominence in the 60s, in particular through the Vietnam War. I guess, you know, Paul went through some very interesting political evolutions in his career. He began as very conservative, but I think he became more broad-minded over time, and he retained a conservative point of view. He was very stylized. His way of speaking, his manner of speaking, you would know instantly who we were talking about if you heard it. He always ended his broadcast with, "Paul Harvey, good day." And so I was asked, "Are you going to do that?" And I thought, "No, I'm white. I'm not him. Absolutely. Why should I do that?" But we were, the thing that struck me was the Paul Harvey newscast that Bob asked me to do was the noon. He had a morning broadcast, which was 5 minutes, and then he had a noon broadcast that was 15, with no break except for the commercials, which he did. So this meant 15 minutes of copy, and his editor insisted on nice, brief, little, fresh stories. It was like trying to fill the Grand Canyon with a garden trowel. And so we would pour through newspapers. His editor was in Chicago. I was in New York. And at that time, the wire services were not enough, even given the amount of content that they provided, to fill this thing. So we poured through newspapers to pull out little stories and put it together. And I remember going right up to the minute before going on the air and having this big stack of copy in my hands and in this freezing cold studio that everything was duplicated, two microphones, two everything, because he was that important to the network's fortunes.
In case one microphone broke, you had a second.
Yeah, if one went down, he was backed up. And about 15 seconds before I went on the air, I'm sitting there nervous as I could be, because it was just scary. And Bob is standing outside, and Bob, among other things, is an amazing practical joker. And so he comes walking up to the door. I see him coming up, and I think he's just going to, you know, lean in and say good luck. The clock's ticking. It's 10 seconds till. He's watching the clock. At about 7 seconds, he opens the door and says, "Hey, Tom." "Yeah." "How's it feel to talk to 22 million people?" Boom. You're on. Wow. I had a lump in my throat that I chased through that entire 15 minutes. In fact, I've got one now thinking about it. Oh, my God. Scared me to death.
Well, speaking of sort of human interest stories, what's one of the more stranger or interesting stories you've ever you worked on?
It would have to be my experience in Spartanburg, South Carolina, which was not a happy one. In fact, it's the reason that I use my first and middle name, Tom Martin, my full name, and I'm fine with anybody knowing this now that I'm not there, is Tom Martin Brown, like Brown without an R. I was also told later on, because I wanted to go back to my full name, it's too easily confused with Brown. It's, you know, and you're going to have to deal with that for the rest of your life. So anyway, I was young, I was maybe 23. I was sent to cover a rally by the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan outside of Spartanburg. I was not at all pleased with this, because obviously I don't care for that organization one little bit. But on the other hand, I thought, well, somebody needs to report this and see what's going on out there. And so I did. This was after South Carolina had recently, in a fit of progressiveness, had passed a law to try to discourage Klan gatherings, prohibiting anybody, any group of more than three people, from covering their faces.
Oh, good idea, yeah.
So when I went to this rally and pulled up in the WORD news car, it was a big old Ford Galaxy with WORD written in red letters along the side. And by the way, the Klan doesn't like the news media. The first thing I noticed was all these individuals with their hoods pushed back. And I started recognizing some of them. And among them were some city officials. And so I realized this is a story. And so, again, I don't know if this is naivete or what, because I was duty-bound to report it. But I did and reported who I saw there and was instantly contacted by the FBI, who wanted me to corroborate some of their intel. And because I was using my full name, our phone began to ring at home, and we were getting threats a couple of days. And so that's when I looked for the job in Pittsburgh and went to Pittsburgh. And while I was there, do we have time for another story?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was there, there was a disc jockey there at night. This was a top 40 music radio station. There was a guy on the air at night by the name of Jeff Christie. And this is a kind of from the frying pan to the fire story. And he kept talking politics. And the general manager put him on notice a couple of times. You can't do that. This is a music station. Stop it. You're going to lose your job if you keep it up. And he kept it up. He was that bullheaded. And so several of us were standing out on the hall the day that Jeff Christie was walking down the hall, and the general manager came barreling up the hallway with steam coming out of his ears and said, "I've warned you. This is your third time you're out. Get out of here. Clean out your closet, your locker. You may have a future in sales, but you have no future in radio. Get lost." This guy left, went back home to Cape Girardeau, Missouri. There was an assistant program director at KQV who kind of liked what Jeff did on the air. And this guy went on to a job at a station in Sacramento, California, with a gentleman working with a guy by the name of Roger Ailes.
Yeah, that sounds familiar to me.
Yeah.
So the program director remembers Jeff Christie and decides, there's something there. Let's see if we can create something called talk radio. And we'll have an agenda. And we'll get this guy who can carry that agenda to come, and we'll develop him into a personality. And so fast forward to 1990, my first day on the job at WABC. I worked at the local station as well as the network. And I was sitting there in the newsroom, and this guy comes walking around. He's got a big suit on. The Jeff Christie I knew had long hair and, wore bell bottoms, actually. And so this guy's got a suit on, and he turns around and says, "Tom, is that you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Don't you know who I am?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I know who you are." And he said, No. "You knew me as Jeff Christie. But his name was Rush Limbaugh." And I wound up working 25 feet from Rush for 5 years.
Wow.
And it was a...
And knew him from South Carolina.
From Pittsburgh.
I'm sorry, from Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Was he conservative in Pittsburgh, or was he a little...
Yeah, we just didn't really understand what he was doing. we were all... It was a rock station. That's where our heads were. And at that time, in 1970, this would have been about 72, 73, there was no politically oriented talk radio. So we had no idea what he was doing.
Roger Ailes, of course, the CEO of Fox News.
And was.
Until recently.
Right.
He's moved to the great beyond.
Yep. And was Nixon's communications director, and was also Reagan's.
Okay, so that's actually a good segue. We're talking to Tom Martin. He's an experienced media professional in Kentucky. So you came back, and one of your first jobs was as a director of communications in Frankfurt.
Well, I came back here actually to go to work for WVLK. They gave me an opportunity to create a format that I'd always wanted to try, called the World's First Rhythm and News Show, which was kind of a conflation of music and news and information interviews. And then the opportunity came about to create WRVG at Georgetown College. And it was to be a 50,000-watt FM music-oriented public radio station. And I couldn't pass that up. And we actually also created a little nationwide news network called World Radio. That had 25 affiliates from Eugene, Oregon to New York City. And we actually were doing those newscasts right out of the studio in Georgetown, Kentucky.
Wow.
And the college eventually sold the station. And that's when I went to work for the lieutenant governor first, Steve Henry. That was an experience. And then everybody's nodding knowingly in here.
Whose lieutenant governor was he? What year are we talking about?
Paul Patton.
Oh, okay. All
right. Right. And yeah. And then from him to become communications director for the Speaker of the House, who was then Jody Richards. And that was also a great, wonderful experience.
Was okay. So you ended up leaving Frankfurt with some distaste, but not completely ruined.
I don't know anybody that doesn't leave Frankfurt with at least some distaste. It would not be normal. But again, another opportunity happened. My next door neighbor, Chuck Creasy, was walking down the street one day and came up to me and raised the prospect of helping him start up a business publication here in Lexington, mm-hmm. Business Lexington. And I was a little skeptical because I'd never done print before. And so I was actually skeptical of my own capability, of my ability to do that. But he was persistent and encouraging and offered whatever help he could to help me do it. And we started Business Lexington as a biweekly, and that was an absolute, utter joy, as it turned out. It was so much fun. And so fast forward to 2013, due to dynamics in the industry, which we may touch on here, they cut back, and I found myself not working there anymore.
You still, though, have, you've got your biweekly column that you do for the Lexington Herald Leader mm-hmm. with an associated podcast that's kind of Q&A. And is it fair to say that you focus primarily on business?
It's on the business page, so I do. There is a little bit of leniency from time to time in what I can go into. The nice thing about that beat, though, business and economy, is that practically everything somehow relates to it.
Right.
So there's a way to make it work. In fact, we were just talking about an interview I've done with Graham Rolls coming up, who's a gerontologist at UK, on the dilemma that those of us who are now in our quote-unquote retirement years. And I say that because it doesn't compute to the baby boomer generation. And the dilemma we find ourselves in that we don't want to quit. And we want to remain productive and do good things and do good work. So that may have some application to business, but it was also very much sociological.
Is it difficult now I guess not. You've got five jobs, but you applying your intellectual curiosity to this medium now, is that challenging? You were talking about kind of paradigm shifts or shifts mm-hmm. in the industry.
Well, the most challenging thing that I've encountered lately that is absolutely a joy is becoming the advisor for the student newspaper, Transylvania. I'm 67, and I have six kids, and they're aged 22 through 45. So I've got a pretty good deal of exposure to young minds, but there is nothing to compare with 18 to 21-year-olds mm-hmm. who are in pursuit of an education. Nothing compares to the intellectual stimulation of being around that.
And you play keyboards.
I do.
As well, in the Patrick McNeese Band.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And that's our intro.
Yeah,
on a weekly basis.
I was really blown away that you're using that.
So how do you? Is music a passion of yours? Been a passion for a long time.
Always
has
been.
Where? How did you get involved in the band? And
I started playing in bands when I was 14 in Moorhead.
Oh wow!
And then was in a band for a while called the Students of Soul, which became a backup band for the Four Shakers Review here in Lexington. So it was the Students of Soul and the Four Shakers Review. It was a big R&B band. And then a post-Magnificent Seven iteration of the Mag Seven, and with apologies to the original members because I know that they chafe at the thought because they were the Mag Seven. That was the greatest band in Kentucky, along with the Torquays in back in the day. And I've just been involved in bands all my life, ever since then, wherever I've been. And most recently, my three of my sons were here in Lexington over at Shangri-La Studios, and we recorded an album together. They're all playing as well.
Okay. Tom, because we're kind of running out of show here, I want to be able to touch on a couple more of the projects or endeavors that you're involved with. First of all, if you could describe to our audience what Undermain is.
Undermain is a cultural affairs publication that's strictly online, and you can find it by going to under-main.com. We have a heavy emphasis on the arts. And literature and music, but we also sometimes get into matters that pertain to the Lexington and the regional culture here. It's a partnership with two other people, Art Sheckett and Christine Huskisson, and it's self-funded. There are no ads. It's not cluttered by advertising. We have an application in play at the moment to become a 501c3, nonprofit. And that's the track that we want to be on, because we want to try to remain as uncluttered as possible, although we do want to begin to offer opportunities for underwriting and sponsorship, but in a tasteful way.
Is it reporting, or are you doing more features?
It's mostly features, and it's an opportunity for writers in the community, contributing writers in the community, to step up and do reviews. We want to bring critical review to the Lexington market, because we believe that that matures an arts community. So we have a few reviews on the site now. We found a number of very talented young writers who are very good at it, and it's been a delight to discover that.
Do you like now writing with an ability to have, like, you know, the first person, a little bit more bias as a columnist than as a newsman? Do you appreciate that?
Well, actually, my column is a Q&A.
Okay.
So it's me asking questions. I do a ton of research before I do those interviews, and quite often even meet with the people I'm going to interview to get a sense of them. So I guess it could be said that the course of the questioning that I do is in some way more first person, because it's coming from me, and I'm determining what we're going to cover and talk about.
And one final thing before we let you go here. I know that you're the owner of a media relations company, so if you could tell us about TM Media Relations.
That's brand new. That's something that I'm experimenting with. I just reasoned that I have all these years of experience in media, and it turns out, as I've been fortunate to do all of them, radio, television, print, online, and so why not share that information with people that are perhaps uncomfortable in interacting with the media, that need expertise in formatting and executing a press conference, or are about to be interviewed and are scared to death of the idea. There are certain techniques that I frankly think that my colleagues in the news media would appreciate, because quite often an interview with somebody who's not prepared can lead you to have to really find the needle in the haystack.
Right.
And so what I'd like to do is help people be a little bit more concise in their responses, a little more clear.
Are these training courses, or do you just, you know, you sit down with somebody and you get coffee with them and they're delighted to have your experience?
It's more that, more of an informal conversation, but based on a template, on a plan, a plot. Fortunately, one friend of mine who went on to be the NBC Today Show men's correspondent for a while, and then he was the token male on The View, a guy named Bob Berkowitz, now works for Dillon Schneider, which is a consulting firm in New York, and he shared with me his techniques, how he trains people to interact with the news media for an interview. So I've got that in my quiver, that arrow in my quiver, and it's really interesting stuff, especially as a reporter, because I'm seeing, oh, So that's how you change the subject. Now I know. So I'm going to use that with students at Transy and say, here's what you look for. These people are being trained out there by people like me to avoid your question.
He has been generous enough to give us his time for free, even though I feel like we're stealing it from him. We've been on with Tom Martin, experienced media professional. If you want to check out his media relations company, you can go to tmmediarelations.com. If you want to check out his columns or his podcasts that come out biweekly for the Lexington Herald Leader, go to kentucky.com. His local cultural scene in Lexington website is Under Maine. That's under-maine.com. If you're interested in some amateur journalism, he's going to be the student newspaper advisor for Transylvania University. You can read some of that work at transyrambler.com. And if you're interested in just some hot keyboard action, you can go to thepmband.com. That's the Patrick McNeese Band. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you all. I really enjoyed it.
That's going to do it for us today. Until next week, have a good weekend, Lexington. This is Bluegrass Bios on Lexington Community.